without receiving a full scale of mobilization and anticipating that we will receive such approval. Super Loki, at my right here, is our planning manager. He will be taking you through each of the individuals and setting that up as we come along through the pieces. Lou Bedford in the back here is handling our press relations with this, so he'll be available. What we're proposing to do is pretty well go through the program, handle points of clarification when they're needed, but then have a Q&A session at the end of this for 15 or 20 minutes, whatever is necessary for everybody to be able to get the level of comprehension that you're comfortable with through the program. We hope that you enjoy it. We are prepared to discuss it in the follow-up in whatever detail is appropriate for you. The presentation today is strictly limited to that shoreline cleanup phase, how we wrap that up, and to the waste disposal program. Okay, thank you. Chip, it's yours.
Okay, let's start out. One of the real critical issues is the environmental ecological guidelines have been developed. Andy Teal will be the person who will speak to these issues.
Andy Teal is being introduced as the speaker to speak to environmental and ecological guidelines.
Welcome. Again, my name is Andy Teal, and I head up our shoreline cleanup advisory team, which is a technical advisory team that identifies and develops our strategy and evaluation process for the shorelines to provide input for the implementation of the plan. The two things that I wanted to briefly review with you today, as we did with the Admiral, and the two areas really are priority as to where we're focusing our energies and attention in the shoreline strategy, and then how that leads into the actual strategy and therefore the implementation of that strategy. As you're all probably well aware, through the Joint Shoreline Committee that I'm involved with and a part of, we have gone through an elaborate and very thorough sensitivity analysis as far as where the ecological, environmental, as well as resource sensitivities are, and make sure that those issues are being fully addressed in the development of any plan. Within those sensitivities, the discussions we've had, obviously we have to prioritize to ensure that we have identified the critical sensitivities as far as addressing those areas the first, and in fact identifying timing windows, times when we should and should not be in a particular area for cleanup. It has to be a very flexible process, responsive to all resource needs. There's a number of other issues that have to be looked at, not only from an environmental perspective, but resource utilization obviously has to be included in that evaluation, and therefore involved in the prioritization. Really, this process and the Joint Shoreline Committee that we've worked very, very cooperatively with and on as part of that Shoreline Committee has provided that focus for our activities and, in fact, areas of inactivity, as I've already indicated. Perhaps some examples where we've flagged areas where inactivity may be an issue in areas such as herring spawning grounds, for example. Where the herring are actively spawning, we've had spotters out there from a biological perspective making sure we're identifying these areas and relaying that information to the cleanup strategy and implementation teams to make sure we're not in those areas during those times. Another timing window that we've been looking at and working very readily towards is the pinniped haulout areas. And I think everybody's familiar with this issue that in fact the pupping season will be starting mid-May. The timing window there is to try and clean those areas prior to May 10th. So there's a restrictive window there as far as actual cleanup activity taking place. Those are the kinds of priorities and the process that we've been going through within the Joint Shoreline Committee, and how that fits into the overall development of the strategy that leads to the implementation plan. Perhaps I could just further that by referring to page 34 in the document that you have. There it identifies how we go about the categorizing as well as the prioritization of the sensitivities in the planning for cleanup. What we call the class one is the most sensitive issue at this time in the process. Right now, of course, the Pinnipet haulout areas on the five islands that have been identified where activity does take place as far as the Pinnipet haulouts and the pupping. Those areas are what we call class one, highest priority, and the focus of our energy at this point in time. In addition to that, as we go down the list, class two, heavily contaminated areas where environmental sensitivities are in close proximity or in proximity to the degree of oiling, where the oiling actually takes place. And those areas are also high priority at this point, especially when we're looking at the Pinnipet haulout areas. And that's where we have a dual focus right now. Not only are we making sure we're getting into to clean the Pinnipet haulout areas prior to May 10th, we also want to be trying to get the majority of the oil in these, in close proximity to where these haulout areas are. And in fact, two examples of that, north side of Smith Island and the northeast shore of Seal Island, are in fact in close proximity to the Pinnipet haulout areas. So that's why there's a focus in those areas as well as the actual haulouts themselves. Okay, given that and given those kinds of shorelines, if you think about where these Pinnipet haulout areas are, and most of you I'm sure have seen them, and these heavily areas, the heavily oiled areas in close proximity to them, there is in fact a number of challenges there as far as the cleanup crews. In fact, these areas of high exposure, shall we say, rocky shorelines, are a real challenge as far as the cleanup effort. And in fact, we've presented our cleanup crews the greatest challenge early in the game, shall we say, up front. And so this is obviously a significant challenge for them while they're gearing up and getting the cleanup activities up to speed. They've also got this additional challenge of the access and the ruggedness of the shorelines they have to get in and clean. We believe it can be done, though, as far as those haulout areas, to get in, get them clean prior to May 10th. And I think when you see the modifications and the implementation of enhancement programs for enhancing recovery of the oil in these kinds of areas, that you'll agree that there is a lot of effort going into developing the most effective means of recovering the oil in these areas. Okay, one other thing that I just wanted to mention that requires consideration when we're looking at our strategy and cleanup priorities, etc., is the issue of natural self-cleaning of the shorelines. This is particularly true in areas of high energy shorelines. And in fact, research and also actual spill experience has indicated that shorelines that are lightly oiled in areas of high energy environments self-clean very readily. The Joint Shoreline Committee is in general agreement with this concept. Where shorelines are lightly oiled and in areas of high energy, where both resource and environmental sensitivities are not an issue. And so, given that, we are looking at incorporation of that strategy concept within the plan. Those are the three areas that I wanted to just briefly bring up with you as far as the prioritization process, the cooperative approach and involvement with the number of agencies that are involved through the Joint Shoreline Committee, through to the prioritized strategy that's identified on page 34, as well as the natural cleansing process that in fact does take place out there in the lightly oiled, high energy environments. So I'll leave those three thoughts with you, and I will be available later should we require further discussion.
Is one of our managers in charge of the initiation of the implementation stage of the program outlined in November?
Don Carpenter is next.
The shoreline restoration plan, you'll see the general discussion of personnel and equipment and military support part of our program. As we started off in the shoreline restoration plan early on, we saw we were making more progress than we first thought. On the 21st of April, we looked at where we were and what was happening. At that point in time, we had four landing craft currently working on the beach. We had another one being loaded out and going to the beach. And we already had 250 personnel working there. So on April 21st, we sat back and did an overnight planning effort to see just how far ahead of the schedule that we could accelerate our business. And really, to make that work, we had to have three things take place. One, we had to have the personnel to man the ships. We had to have some additional support. And the best place we thought we could receive that would be through the military. We did have the USS Juno that was en route to us. At the time, we had not committed its use, but we did know what its capabilities were, so we're looking at it. Of course, the third thing that was really vital to our operation was having the equipment, or the cleaning equipment, to go on these vessels to actually go out and attack the shoreline in an accelerated basis. What we've done since then is, in the various areas, the first page you have is page 6, is first take a look at the personnel involved. We visited with our contractor, who was VECO. There were certainly ample applications for jobs from people in the area to go out and do the work. They seemed to be qualified to handle the kind of work that we had for them out in this operation. So we began immediately to work with them to build up rapidly to the kind of strength that we would need to man 20 total landing craft by the end of April or the 1st of May. That has not been a problem. As we came into the first week of, or the last week of April, on April the 25th, we were able to board the USS Juno with an additional 300 oil response technicians to begin their operation. And at the same time, we put aboard the USS Juno some 16 Exxon supervisors and an additional number of supervisors from our contractor, VECO. So the first part of that plan worked well for us. We were able to bring the people in. We had some concerns in doing that because part of those people, about half that 300 people, came out of the Valdez area, and we knew we could pick them up that day and put them on the ship. But we had to bring about 150 personnel in. We had some concerns about bringing them in on the impact we'd have on the community. But we were able to get these people out of Cordova, brief them a day early, bring them over the day that the Juno arrived, or the day after it arrived, and actually go aboard the ship after a briefing that day. So the logistics of getting the people out had very little impact here, and we were able to load out in a timely manner to get the people that we needed. Page 7 of the handout that you have shows the kind of buildup that we are anticipating in the shoreline cleanup operation. You can see there at the end of April, we're expecting to have some 700 people working in this operation. We now have over 1,000 people committed in this effort already. So for the first part of it, from a personnel standpoint, we've been able to meet the commitment and get the people on location. We're very pleased with the people that we received. We have had some turnover in the operation. The first day the USS Juno was there, 9 people asked to come in, which we brought in at the end of that work day. The second day of its operation, we had 13 of the 300 people asked to come in, and we complied with that request. The second part of our plan to accelerate the onshore cleanup operation dealt with our military support. You'll see on page 8 a general discussion of the military support that we have both requested and received. The most important piece of that, of course, is the USS Juno. It was en route to Valdez and arrived on schedule on April the 24th. On that particular day, we boarded the USS Juno with Exxon supervisor personnel, briefed the Navy captain and Admiral Baker and the crew on what our plans were for the use of that vessel. And I guess the most impressive thing we had happen in that was the real spirit of the people on the USS Juno and their can-do attitude and how they were willing to help us in this cleanup operation. We had a list of concerns that we had and things that needed to be done in order to use that vessel and in order to deploy it effectively and in a fast, efficient manner. And we weren't denied any of those requests. Matter of fact, we found the crew on that particular vessel gave us a lift in our spirits at that particular time because we'd moved very rapidly in just a very short amount of time for this buildup. Because of that attitude and the planning that had been done, we were able to outfit the USS Juno beginning the evening of April 24th, add the personnel and equipment on April the 25th, and actually sail out into the Sound on April 26th and begin our onshore cleanup operations with that vessel. And it's not only been the cooperation with the Navy and the USS Juno that's been very valuable to us. We've had a similar type cooperation from all the services, the U.S. Coast Guard vessels and personnel located with us here, and the requests that we've made and the action that we've needed have been extremely cooperative with us. We have other naval vessels out. We have U.S. Army skimmers. We have the Oscar computer management control system, which has come up on speed fast and has been very useful to us. And then the Air Force itself, too, has added to us some 300 decontamination units, which are warm water sprayers. We started moving those to the location. We moved 22 of those out yesterday. We were observing them in the operation yesterday, and they have been very useful in the operation. So we've had the support we needed to accelerate the progress to date, and that's just what we needed. Page 9 of your handout talks about the equipment itself. Of course, it wouldn't have done us very much good to get the people and the vessels out there if we didn't have the oil spill cleanup equipment itself aboard. We began looking on the evening of April the 21st, and our first estimate was is that we could man an additional 8 landing craft with full equipment to go offshore and begin work. By taking a look at the equipment and the supplies that were in the pipeline, we discovered that we could equip and man an additional 7 landing craft by the end of the week or near May 1st. So we went ahead and began implementing the program to put that equipment on the vessels. I can tell you that on May the 1st, we had moved from the 4 landing craft that we had operating on April the 21st to May 1st, we had 16 operating. Today, we have 19 landing craft fully equipped and operating in the onshore cleanup plan. We have 2 additional that are en route, and we have the USS Fort McHenry that's now scheduled to arrive on this Friday. So at this point in time, we feel very confident that we'll be able to muster the resources and muster the equipment and get the support we need to accelerate the cleanup program to meet the schedule that you'll see later on today in our onshore cleanup plan. And really to help you understand some of the things we're doing on that and some of the enhancements we're making to further increase the productivity, Bill Rainey, who's our operations manager, will come and discuss some of the actual cleanup equipment we're using and that we're anticipating to use.
Bill Rainey is the next speaker. We just heard from Don Carpenter.
I plan on covering 2 subjects with you. A handout is being passed around right now that covers our shoreline restoration production to date. You'll note that this is a bar chart that shows the cumulative yards of beach clean since we began deployment of our beach wash operations on April the 11th. You will note as you look through the days that around April the 23rd, we began to run into bad weather and accomplished very little until, again, about the 27th. We had a day of good weather, halted again on the 28th. And as you can see, the bars jump up significantly beginning on April the 29th when we had the combination of good weather and a large number of resources compared to the pass out cleaning beach. Cleaned about 200 yards on April the 29th. That increased to 300 on the 30th, which is the last day I showed data for on the chart, and also the day that we hit 1 mile. I might mention a few things that are different on the cleanup that occurred on April the 30th versus what you can envision as we progress with the cleanup over the course of the summer as depicted in this plan. One is, as Andy Teal mentioned, the areas that we're cleaning now are definitely the most heavily oiled of the beaches that we have to clean up, so we're hitting the areas that take the most time. the haul-out area, such as Applegate Rock. We were working also a difficult challenge for cleanup in the sense of there's a lot of tidal action out there, and at high tide there's only a few rocks. At low tide there's a larger area to clean, and it's much steeper than many of the areas where we'll be working in the future. Another significant difference is the average depth of the beach that we have to clean over the summer is about 30 feet, and that's the average that's depicted in this plan. The areas where we worked on the 30th are over three times that deep. They average about 100 feet in depth. In terms of the resources that we have cleaning on the 30th versus those that we'll have when we build up to full capacity as a plan, we had 16 landing crafts that were active on the beaches on the 30th. That will build to 33. We had one maxi barge with hot water, warm water flushing capability, which is the most successful operation that we've had to date. We will build to 13 of those maxi barges as we go through the build up to maximum. And the last difference I'll mention is we indicated we have about 300 of the Air Force hot water flushing units, handheld units that are coming in. We had only a handful of those decontamination units on hand on the 30th. So all of these put together give us great confidence that we can execute the plan as indicated in the documents in front of us. Let me now move on to page 17 of the book in front of you and talk about potential mechanical enhancements to the plan that was submitted to you previously. Many of these are already being implemented or have been implemented, and I will indicate that as I go through the steps. Others are more in the conceptual planning stage. I'll try to distinguish between the two. What I would like for you to keep in mind is that we believe that all of the enhancements that I'll be talking about are within the original intent and scope of the cleanup plan. We have asked Admiral Robbins to consider these as part of our base plan as he reviews the document. The first that I've indicated is the Omni Sweep. That's an adaptation of a hydraulically operated telescope concrete pump. A prototype of this device has already been tested here in Valdez on the back of the truck, on the back of a truck sweeping streets. It has proven to be very effective here on land, and we think that it will be a big supplement to our cleanup operations as we deploy the first test device within the next few days. There's a conceptual diagram of that piece of equipment on page 18 in the book in front of you. We have one of these telescoping devices that is on site now and is being equipped on the barge Striker. That barge also has its own heating equipment so that this device will be able to have a warm water flush. A big advantage that we expect to have on this is that we will be able to reach very rocky areas that are otherwise difficult to access from a landing craft. That will be especially helpful to us as we clean up the seal haul-out areas that Andy Teal mentioned earlier. A second one is on site and is being assembled. If this is a successful test, then we expect to build up several more barges with this type of equipment to add to the fleet that we've previously discussed with you. A similar idea that I've listed next is we have cranes on each one of the maxi barges. If you'll notice the diagram for the layout of a maxi barge, there is an arm on one side of the barge that will be used as a spray header for the beach. On the other side of the barge from the articulating arm is a crane. We believe that we can hook up that crane with a telescopic boom that will look similar to the Omni-Sweep device that you see, so that on our maxi barges we'll be able to sweep the beach from both ends of the barge. Another idea, and is certainly proven equipment, is elevated remotely controlled fire monitors and cannons. Many of you may have seen these on firefighting boats in the various harbors that we have. The advantage of these is that they give a controlled amount of water and a relatively careful aim for long distances. I've seen some that shoot at least 50 to 100 yards. We would hope to supplement our LCVs with that type of equipment. Another area that's perhaps a bit further away, but would be a monster along these lines, are the equipment that we use to build ice islands in areas such as Prudhoe Bay and our exploration and production operations. These devices spray water at a rate of 5,200 gallons per minute, as opposed to about 150 gallons per minute for the OmniSweep that I previously mentioned. An area that's already been implemented, if you've observed any of our current beach cleanup operations, is to replace the rigid aluminum pipe headers that we were using for Deluge Beach with flexible perforated header hose that achieves much better conformance to the actual shoreline profile. Another area that we're looking at implementing, and it should be relatively simple, is to add our equipment in terms of handheld hoses that supplement the beach deluge. If you'll notice the operations that go on now, most of the handheld hoses are operated by their own small pump, which is offloaded off of the LCVs each day and carried out to the beach itself. We would intend to hook up to one of our 1,000-gallon per minute pumps on the LCV itself, a manifold which will allow hooking up, say, 10 or more handheld hoses to supplement those that are operated by the pumps on shore. One that also is in the current stage of implementation is a modification of our maxi barge design with containerized major equipment replacement modules. That would be for pumps, heaters, so forth, as you see in the diagram there. That will be an advantage to us in two ways. One is it will allow more rapid assembly of equipment on the maxi barges as they have been initially assembled. Equally important, if we have an equipment failure and downtime, rather than repairing the equipment on the barge itself, we'll be able to lift out a module and replace it with a similar module and quickly get back into operation. We're looking into a number of other options on increasing the efficiency and the quantity of warm water producers that have been proven very effective in much of our beach cleanup service. We're looking at several options on deploying equipment on vessels that will be on the beach each day. Also looking at the possibility of a land-based water heating device. The advantage there is we could assemble a much larger boiler onshore rather than offshore and shuttle water back and forth to the beaches with heated barges, such as the kind that we now use to deliver asphalt to petroleum customers. That one is in more of a conceptual stage of planning at this point. The next one may not sound like a big item. It's primarily a safety item, but one that we will be exploring with the USS McHenry when she arrives is the use of prefabricated shower units that can be put upon the naval vessel itself. If you recall, the landing craft from the naval vessel can board the vessel when she drops down the back end of the vessel, and there's a berthing area inside the vessel itself. The way we currently have shower facilities for people on barges adjacent to the vessel, we have to have a safe way to deploy people inside the vessel from the landing craft in rough weather. This would allow them to shower when they get out. Another area we're pursuing are specialized self-contained boiler vessels that would operate tandem to pumpers. That would allow us to put a larger vessel on a barge, operate it in tandem with a pumper vessel, and get warm water much closer to the work face than we currently are able to do. Also looking at preheater units, both fired and waste heat recovery ambient type units that would increase the water supply temperature to more of an ambient temperature mode. And last, and also very important, is to improve our skimming capability for shoreline cleanup. One of the options that we're looking at now, in addition to the conventional skimmers that you've seen operating out of the harbor for free oil cleanup, is to use more absorbent snares and mops. And we have to have a way to get the oil out of those snares, if you will, so that they can be reused. We're looking at mechanized rollers that would drop into a self-contained bin for the oil with a pump to then pump it into a vessel that would contain the oil for later disposal. This would allow us to very rapidly take soaked absorbent, run it through the rollers, and have it ready for deployment again. I hope you'll note that these are a number of ideas that we've come up with, many of which have already been implemented or in the stage of implementation after really only a few days of experience with a large number of people operating these landing craft. We're encouraged that we have this many ideas on our plate already, and we think that you'll see many more come in the weeks to come. And these ideas, of course, that are not only coming from Exxon people, we have a number of teams out in the field observing these operations with members from the Coast Guard and the various agencies. They're getting together with our people at the end of each day and talking about what went well, what can be improved, and how to implement those improvements. So I think that you'll see the number of ideas escalate from this point, but we feel good about the ones on our platter at the moment. And the next speaker will discuss some of the other areas that we're looking at beyond the mechanical to improve our cleanup plan.
Right now, Al Mackey, who's our environmental manager.
Al Mackey, who is the environmental program manager for Exxon, will be the next speaker. You're listening to a live press briefing at the Exxon Conference Room in the Royal Center in downtown Valdez. Here's Al Mackey.
Some of the options that we're considering and some of the procedural steps that we've implemented to begin looking at alternative cleanup measures. To date, Exxon has received well over 1,000 proposals for assistance in various shapes and forms. The task force has been established with our Exxon Research and Engineering Laboratories in Florham Park, New Jersey, to begin the identification, categorization, and sorting of these various options. We're looking at things such as chemical, non-chemical, biological, physical hardware, services, and so on. The process is to first identify those potentially applicable in the near term, and running those through additional levels of screening and background data collection prior to discussion with all the appropriate agencies. So this task force is now logging these options in and considering where they might best apply. I'll discuss with you here now this pages 19 through 23 of our plan, which walk through some of the procedures we have in place. The objectives of their evaluation effort are to provide recommendations to the Exxon team here in Alaska on these options. We're particularly interested in identifying means of accelerating the base cleaning operation beyond the existing capability. We're also interested in options that would enhance our ability for handling of wastes, such as options for waste minimization or disposal, removal of oil from the shorelines. What ways can we enhance the removal rate and the removal efficiency, and ultimately reach enhanced cleanliness in the shoreline areas? So the guidelines that we're operating under with our task force are primarily focused on environmental acceptability and safety as the key parameters of the evaluation program. The toxicology screening data and safety review are being done by the Exxon Biomedical Sciences Department in East Millstone, New Jersey. They're providing all of the appropriate EPA database information for the toxicology and safety of new chemical options. We're trying to emphasize technology and equipment, certainly that are initially compatible with the Coast Guard approved plan, and we recognize that many of the options that have been proposed to us are beyond present Coast Guard approved plan and would require full agency endorsement prior to application in the Sound. So the review of the proposals will be documented in standard format, and this all information will be available in a computerized database to track the proposals and allow an initial assessment of where they might best apply. So in process then, the materials and inquiries are logged in and documented. The initial screening and environmental safety data for overall efficiency are then performed at the Exxon Research and Engineering Labs. Those with showing some degree of initial promise and having sufficient supporting data will be rapidly identified and recommended for potential field test use here in Prince William Sound. Prior to doing any actual field testing, we will assemble a full proposal with supporting safety information and environmental data to share with the Coast Guard and the relevant agencies, and we'll then get an initial agreement for a test program. The field tests will be designed and conducted in Prince William Sound by Exxon contractors, Dr. Ed Owens and his staff at Woodward Clyde, working closely again in concert with the agencies to ensure full involvement of the appropriate environmental staffs and full review, participation in the study design, and actual study conduct. Looking then at the field test data, we will then implement it immediately, summarize it, and share it with the relevant agencies again prior to any full-scale use in Prince William Sound in the large-scale cleanup program. So that's how the process will work, at least on paper. Now let's just look at one compound that is working its way through this process. The next couple of pages share with you some information on a particular surfactant that seems to have some promise, at least. Material is referred to as Corexit 7664. We know that it does augment shoreline cleaning. It has a long history of use in actual field applications. It's been around for some 20-plus years, where it has been used in spill sites to help shoreline cleaning. We now have pilot tests underway in the laboratory to demonstrate the application of this particular material to shoreline cleaning. It is a surfactant type material, and the plan will be to conduct on-site small-scale tests in the next few weeks, looking at representative habitats and trying to get a feeling for how relevant it is under field conditions. We'll be looking at defining additional usages. You've heard already for enhanced cleaning via warm water. A number of other chemicals are showing some initial promise. We'll be sharing field test plans with you in the ensuing weeks on these options also. We are working closely with EPA on a technique referred to as bioremediation. This is one where the natural bacterial flora of the nearshore environment are augmented by various nutrient additions, nitrate and phosphate type additions, to enhance biodegradation. Natural biodegradation occurs in these environments, and we would just like to be able to enhance that and maximize the rates of removal. EPA will be conducting research in the field on this particular technique in the next several weeks. They have a fairly large-scale field program underway and in planning stages here now. So that data will be shared with all relevant agency folks also. But then getting back to our field test proposal for 7664, we'd like to propose its potential use in an enhanced cleaning program, utilizing it as a non-toxic, water-based, and biodegradable shoreline cleaner. The plan would be to add it in a 1% solution, in 1 to 5% solution to the water stream, probably using ambient seawater with a potential for warm water wash, and then looking at a side-by-side comparison in a small-scale field test, the Corexit 7664 versus our conventional water flush. Does it indeed show any increased efficiency without any environmental risk? We'll be looking at boulder and rocky beach type habitats as the test sites, and we'll be sampling water column sediment and core samples from the site to follow a full complement of environmental chemistry and provide the data to support full-scale use should that prove to be the right route to go. Currently, tests are underway in the laboratory defining the toxicology to trout and salmon species, as well as several invertebrates representative of the sound, and that data will also be shared prior to any actual field test information. The tests will be finishing up here this week, so we'll provide that data and share it with the agencies in support for the field test. We're aware of this particular material, as I said, has been around for some 20 years. It was used quite successfully in a Tampa Bay spill as early as 1970, and the environmental data from that particular application are very supportive of its use. The field program indicated that chemical cleaning and the resultant effects on the organisms nearshore species inhabiting the Tampa Bay area were minimal. We weren't able to find any decrease in number of species or diversity or density of organisms following use in this field application. So we understand that's a considerably different environment, but at least it is supportive information that it indicates the material doesn't have residual or toxic effects. So that'll again be all part and parcel of a proposal to use this material should it prove efficient from the initial laboratory screens. So there's an idea of how we plan to work through the overall testing program, and we'll be sharing with you new concepts and ideas as they come through the screening process. Okay.
Thank you. Well, we'll turn out in just a minute.
numerous people who have had involved in the program. Kip Berry, who's one of the experts in our communications, telecommunications department, will give you a brief overview of that.
Good morning. My name is Kip Berry. I'm with the telecommunications group. If you'll turn to page 24, that's where we have the plan outlined. I won't go into any real detail on the plan, but rather just summarize it briefly. And I'd like to talk about some additional items that we're doing that are not included in the plan. Basically, our goal here is that we'll provide communication support of the entire cleanup operation in the areas that are currently defined. We're providing operational channels for Exxon's use, Vico use. We're also providing a joint channel, which is shared by all of the various agencies involved, state, federal, and by Exxon. Additionally, we provided what we call a life and safety channel, which is available on all radios, and it gives us the capability of having anyone, either on the shoreline or one of the vessels, switch over to a channel 6 and immediately be able to communicate for life or safety reasons. Talk a little bit about some of the additions that we made not in the plan. About 10 days ago, at the suggestion of John Cameron with the state, we set up a joint communications committee. This consists of Captain Andy Durkee with the Coast Guard, representing the federal level, and John Cameron with the state, and also Bob Black with telecommunications with Exxon. It's a very cooperative committee, and it's worked very well. It's helped facilitate overall efforts in communications. It's working very well for us. If you'll turn to page 27, we've outlined the equipment requirements in support of this operation. Let me just say there that the suppliers are working very well and catching up. We're meeting all of our demands with equipment currently. Looking at mobile radios, we've got the demand met as of now. We've got 100 additional radios in stock, and we've got 100 radios on order. In the area of handhelds, we've got a defined need of 750 radios. We've currently got issued 600 radios. We've got an additional 300 in stock. And to ramp up, we've got an additional 250 on order. So suppliers are working very well with us. We've actually reduced the lead time on some of this equipment down to 4 days. If you look at pages 28 through 32, those are network diagrams of the communications plans. Let me just say only there that all are completed and functioning except the joint communications network. That network is scheduled to be completed next week somewhere around the 10th. One other item, let me pass out a quick handout here. In support of our shoreline operations, you've heard about the Juno that we've got working with us. What we've done is established a series of networks that will be used in support of these kinds of operations, the Juno, other vessels to come down the road. Basically, what it consists of is what we call a local area radio system, which meets the specific requirements of a shoreline party. Provides an Exxon operations channel, a Vico operations channel, and basically we get communications between the various shoreline personnel, the vessels supporting the shoreline, and then back to the command vessel. From there, the command vessel has access into the Valdez area. Again, we also have on all these radios the health or the life and safety channel for emergency use. Excuse me. Moving to outside the sound support. Just this week, we're gearing up down around Homer. We've currently got installed HF, UHF, and marine VHF systems in the Homer area. We're expanding capabilities by putting an earth station installation on Pearl Island, and we'll support that with a tower to support all the same communications facilities that we have working here in the Sound. The area east of Gore Point is a little bit different situation. We don't have any good land basis from which to operate. Our plan there is that we'll use communications vessels, and we'll gear up communications equipment on those vessels to support those areas from Seward down to Gore Point. One item I would just like to highlight, which indicates what I believe is our ability that we're quickly acquiring to move in response to changes as they occur. Last night, John Cameron asked us to provide some support down in a community called Chignik. We've had some, it's down on the peninsula. We've had some oil movement down there, and very quickly last night from about 11:30 to 2 o'clock, we put together all of the communication systems to send down there to that community. It's on the airplane tonight, or this morning, and it'll be there tonight. What it emphasizes is that we're gearing up to be able to respond to these changing situations and provide in various areas immediate communications. That's all I have. Are there any questions? Are we going to defer to the end? Or? Okay.
What we'd like to do now is really get into the bases of the plan. And I've got three of our planning and scheduling experts that have gone through the detailed work, and I'll discuss a little bit the assumptions, the bases, and some of the methodologies, and then I'll just wrap up by summarizing milestones and where our plan is going to lead us to. Steve Tyson, Carter Finn, and Mike Barber will first discuss the plan, the bases, and methodology.
This is KCEG Radio in Valdez, Alaska. My name is Dave Hammack. You're listening to a live broadcast from the Exxon Conference Room in the Royal Center in Valdez.
On my left is Parker Fend. On my right, Mike Vavra. Together, we form a core group in the planning function here that have been involved in the process of developing the program, pulling all the elements together. We have a handout here, and we intend to go through that with you, try and give you a feel in overview terms of the methodology that has been involved in this process, some of the assumptions, the strategy, the things that have guided us, rounding out with an overview of the schedule. On the first page of the handout I've given you, you'll see in graphic form the description of the planning methodology that has been involved here. We start out with an initial estimate of the scope of work, and that is in this case updated almost on a real-time basis.
In this case, updated almost on a real-time basis.